This is Audible.
This is Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. Written by Bruce Campbell, co-written with Craig Sanborn. Narrated by Bruce Campbell.
I'm Bruce Campbell, and this is the Pre-Ramble. Back in 1997, a literary agent named John Hodgman contacted me and asked if I ever considered writing an autobiography. I guess he read a few early, primitive blogs on my website and found them amusing. But writing a book about myself? No, I had never thought about it. But it was an intriguing possibility. I did love reading biographies about actors, but there weren't too many out there about the so-called B-listers. Well, that's exactly the point, John explained. Tell the story of the underexposed working stiffs of the silver screen. So I set about scrawling outlines, anecdotes, and notes on the backs of screenplays. Within a few years, I had managed to come up with enough words and dig up enough old photographs to tell the story of my life. If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor was unleashed upon the literary world in 2001. And I'm proud to confess that it became a New York Times bestseller. That was 15 years ago. As I look back, I realize that if this were a movie, the first book would really only be Act One, where you meet your hero, follow him through his formative years. This might very well be a part two of a three-act story. This book has a little more of the meat of my life as an experienced actor with more adult experiences. I had originally intended to write a travel memoir titled Vagabond, An Actor's Gypsy Life, but my stories were so intrinsically tied to my ongoing career that it all just worked better as my further confessions. If you've already read If Chins Could Kill, the following few pages are a breezy reminder of my life from my childhood in Michigan to my legendary journeys with a warrior princess. If you've never read If Chins Could Kill, well, your life is dull as toast, but it's still available in four different editions, hardcover, trade paperback, audiobook, read by yours truly, and full-color, gently updated ebook. Regardless, I'm about to recap my first tale at the beginning of the new one. Why not? It worked for Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness. Previously on... The youngest son of Charlie and Joanne, I was born in 1958 outside of Detroit, Michigan. I spent my happy childhood digging tunnels, building forts, and creating UFO scares with my brothers, Mike and Don. I was your typical suburban kid, until one fateful day in 1966 when I saw my father performing on stage as part of a local theater troupe. The thespian seed was planted, and it wasn't long before I landed my first role in The King and I at our beloved St. Dunstan's Theater. Local theater was only the beginning. There was something else brewing during my adolescence. Over the years, I met and amassed a tight group of friends, like-minded shimps, we called each other, who rallied together under the banner of Super 8 filmmaking. Super 8 was a grainy, primitive medium, but it was a shared passion in my group, along with the Three Stooges, and we all took turns with the various duties making numerous screwball comedies. My buddies Mike Ditz, Scott Spiegel, Josh Becker, John Cameron, and Dave Goodman were all serious about pursuing the dreams we cultivated together, but one kid named Sam Raimi was a different bird entirely. Sam and I met in drama class in 1975 and bonded immediately over our embarrassing failures at improv. He brought a lot to our filmmaking troupe, including a creative fire, a devilish sense of humor, a goofy little brother, Ted, and a 1973 Oldsmobile Delta Royale. More on that later. High school ended, and thanks to my mother's encouragement, I interned at the Cherry County Playhouse. A valuable learning experience, this was my first time working among professional actors with all their wisdom and quirks. My college career lasted all of 6 months because I already knew what I wanted to do. I believed the best education would be to actually start working in the entertainment industry. I became a production assistant for local commercials and got to see how a real film set operated. The boys and I continued to get together at every opportunity to make more Super 8 shorts. Only now we had a new member, Sam's roommate, Rob Tappert. As we grew, so did the scope and cost of our projects. Sam and Rob's The Happy Valley Kid cost $700, but actually made about $5,000 at the box office slash college campus theater. We began to think that our films might actually be able to make some money. Up next was Sam's ambitious flop, It's Murder. This time he wanted to produce a feature-length story complete with a large cast, stunts, even a car chase. It cost over $2,000, which was a huge amount of money in 1978. Alas, for all of our combined effort and expense, its murder bombed. But within the film was a surprising silver lining that sealed our fates. In one scene, a character lurched forward from the backseat of a car so unexpectedly that it scared the audience every time we showed it. Maybe pratfalls and slapstick weren't the keys to success. What if the path to fortune and glory was paved with shock and horror? Sam, Rob, and I started officially working toward making a feature-length horror film. We started with the production of a proof-of-concept short called Within the Woods that we could screen for potential investors. For all of our inexperience, we were committed to getting our feature funded, made, and distributed. After many months of shooting and several years of effort, expense, injury, and near-sex experiences, our film was finished. With the help of marketing guru Irvin Shapiro and the endorsement of horror authority Stephen King, we were a hit at the 1982 Cannes Film Festival. Soon after, Evil Dead was released in England, but a domestic distributor had yet to be found. Thankfully, the movie took off across the big ditch, second only to the blockbuster E.T. in some areas, and it awoke New Line Cinema's interest here in the U.S. The film was released in 1983 and did very well for New Line Cinema. We got an advance of $125,000, and it was the last penny we ever saw. The emergence of home video came to the rescue, and Evil Dead ultimately sold more than a million VHS tapes through Thorn EMI, an astonishingly reputable video distributor. None of this happened overnight. The film was shot in 1979, released in 1982, 83, and took 6 years to break even. In this case, it was the rights fee to make Evil Dead 2 that put the original movie partnership in the black. Based on the strength of foreign sales for the first film, the sequel came together very quickly. We were happy to get back to a world we understood after our second film, Crime Wave, died 1,000 deaths. Evil Dead 2 was so sought after, partner Rob Tappert walked on the set during pre-production and announced that the film was already in profit due to pre-sales of various rights around the world. When Evil Dead 2 came out in 1987, it did moderately well at the box office, but it didn't seem to matter. We already made what we were going to make, profit-wise. By then, I was a working actor, living in Los Angeles with my family, wife Christine, daughter Rebecca, and son Andy. The Evil Dead movies had established me as a horror guy, and I was cast in a slew of B-movies, ranging from psycho slasher flicks to sci-fi adventures. As the 90s approached, I joined Josh Becker and Dave Goodman in producing Josh's indie comedy Lunatics, A Love Story. Alas, with repeated extended absences, the film industry can be brutal to families, and I returned home from shooting Lunatics to discover that Chris wanted a divorce. Despondent, I burrowed back into my B-movie pigeonhole. There, on the set of Mind Warp, I met a feisty costume designer named Ida, who took pity on me and my rusty efforts to woo her. Ida and I were married in 1991 and are still going strong. The next time Evil Dead reared its ugly head was that same year when Sam, Rob, and I convinced Dino De Laurentiis and Universal to team up and make Army of Darkness. This third installment was, to us, epic in proportions. The budget went from 8 to 11 to 13 million. In the process, we put a boatload of our own money in the flick, lost creative control of the editing, and generally had a miserable time making the thing. Army of Darkness made about $13 million at the box office. In order to recoup our inflated budget, we would have to make three times that. The Evil Dead franchise, if you could even call it that, was officially dead in the water. But hey, I couldn't expect to play Evil Dead's Ash character for the rest of my life, could I? Winky wink. I moved into television, landing the lead role in a Fox Western called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. Although fans loved it, the ratings failed to impress the network, and Fox canceled it after one season. Honestly, though, I was a bit relieved. Being a leading man in an hour-long episodic series was exhausting, and I shifted my sights toward supporting characters and one-off TV movies. Roles on Lois and Clark, Ellen, The X-Files, The Love Bug, and other TV gigs mingled with more B-movie roles and the occasional A-lister. In the meantime, Sam and Rob kept busy, starting up a syndicated action show called Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. I directed a few episodes, but my most memorable contribution to the series was my recurring role as Autolycus, the King of Thieves. As Hercules headed toward the end of its six-season run in the late 90s, I began to direct and appear in its successful spinoff, Xena, Warrior Princess. I can honestly say that working on those two shows was one of the most enjoyable experiences of my career. And that, in a B-movie nutshell, was the first 40 years of my life. Still on board? Still interested in reading what I've been up to between then and now? If so, groovy. If not, sorry, no refunds. Chapter 1, Exodus. My mom, even though raised in the Midwest, was a huge fan of Westerns and had a deep fondness for the world to the west of Detroit. As a boy, I doodled little flipbook animations in the corners of her Zane Grey books. The author had written more than 50 Westerns, but I only knew him as the guy who wrote books that I used to draw cartoons. Michiganders had a long-standing tradition of heading south to Florida when weather got bad or the holidays were upon us. My mother broke that tradition. She didn't want to go south. She wanted to go west. "This Christmas, let's go to Phoenix instead," she offered. The family looked at her in unison. "Phoenix? Like Arizona?" we asked. "Yep." "Do they even have Christmas in Arizona?" The takeaway from our western holiday wasn't about fake snow being blown on entire neighborhoods to replicate the season. It was about staring at the vast, empty expanses outside my airplane window on the way to Phoenix. I was transfixed by large areas of desert that still didn't have any roads. How is that even possible? I'd ask myself. It wasn't like I grew up in a really crowded area, but there were always people around. My neighbors, while not packed in tenement style, were everywhere. Every road, and most were paved, had cars on it any time of day. Humanity was a constant. The only respite, and one that I really took to, was property my parents bought outside of Gladwin, Michigan. At 160 acres, it was a quarter-mile square of woods, meadows, and bogs, classic Michigan terrain. My mother designed and oversaw a small but fully functional cabin on a bluff overlooking the lower acreage. Many a weekend was spent at this wonderful getaway. When my parents divorced in 1980, the property was sold as part of the settlement. This turn of events haunts me to this day. When Mom and Dad split, I was still struggling to complete Evil Dead and didn't have a pot to piss in monetarily, so I had to watch helplessly while my personal slice of paradise slipped away. That harrowing experience planted a seed that would grow 20 years later. Post-divorce, Mom moved west to start a new life. She remarried a rancher, and they migrated from one piece of western property to another. Whenever I wanted to see Mom, I'd make my way to wherever she lived at the time. Squim, Washington, Nevada City, California, or Humbug, Oregon. I loved seeing the new places she found, and it really cemented my idea that the West was different in almost every way. First time I saw the Milky Way was out west, while working on Sundown, a vampire in retreat in Moab, Utah. I was astounded. It was real. I felt like I was starting to connect a little bit with the natural world. While making that movie, I explored the Utah outback at every opportunity when I wasn't working. It was the first time in my entire existence while at the Navajo National Monument when the only sound I could hear was the crunch of gravel under my feet on a remote trail. A crow passed by across the canyon, and I could hear its wings flap. So distant was any traffic or ambient human-created noise. Solitude was something I began to crave. When I moved to Los Angeles to pursue acting more seriously, I threw myself into a sea of humanity. Los Angeles has been described many ways. The city of angels, the big orange, La La Land. I call it the city of sloppy seconds. Because ironies abound. The guy with the fancy sports car can't get it over 45 miles an hour because of all the traffic. The health nut unknowingly sucks the equivalent of half a pack of Camels in particulate matter every day. The mellow Californian doesn't really exist. Not in Los Angeles, anyway. About 10 years into my L.A. residency, I was returning from a trip with Ida, my wife and co-conspirator for 25 years now, late in the afternoon. Through the airplane window, we could see the unmistakable pale orange band of smog blanketing the city. This wasn't marine layer or anything atmospheric. This was pure big city smog. Ida and I glanced at each other. I extended my right hand. "Let's make a deal to get the hell out of here in 5 years. She took my hand and shook it firmly. "Deal." To assuage her that we wouldn't starve if we moved out to the boonies somewhere, I drew up a Where Did I Work in 1997 chart. It turned out that 70% of my movie or TV work took place outside of Los Angeles. With better rebate deals being offered by New Zealand, Canada, Bulgaria, and others, film production left California at an alarming rate. Only 30% of my work was in L.A.? Why was I still here? Our 5-year escape plan came to fruition within a year. Go Northwest, young man. By this time, my mother lived in Ashland, Oregon, and she dabbled in real estate. My mom was an early flipper. She loved buying places for cash, fixing them up, and selling them whenever she and her new husband, Bob, got bored. In an exploratory phase, Ida and I were looking for a house that wasn't in a standard neighborhood or even a small town. We wanted a place that was farther out, ideally with land. Oregon seemed like as nice a place as any. It encompassed anything from high desert to mountainous forest to desolate coastline. Oregon was on the same coast as L.A., so the whole time zone thing would be the same, and there was a 2-hour direct flight from Medford to L.A. once a day. This could work. I asked Mom to fax me some real estate listings, and a few of them seemed promising. Ida and I headed north. Oregon in the fall is grand. It's a mix of still warm days, breezy sunshine, and fall colors. The day we accompanied Mom to see the Applegate Valley property was the kind of day real estate agents pray for. Sunny, crisp, with the slightest of breezes to remind us that it was fall. This particular piece of property was situated on a hill with spectacular south-facing views of the Siskiyou Mountains. The setting was very appealing, but the ownership map told me everything I needed to know. Our property was surrounded on 3 sides by land administered by the Bureau of Land Management, BLM. More on them later. And our mountainous view was also either BLM or National Forest Service land. A mountain range with no lights on it. Where do I sign up? I immediately turned into a lousy house negotiator because I instantly wanted the place. Ida, you know when you buy a house, you're supposed to pretend that you're not really interested? Yeah. Well, I don't care. I want to buy this place. I want to whip out a check right now to hold it. Ida was a little stunned. Really? Really. We put a check in the owner's hand as a deposit and bought the place. Just like that, Ida and I were done with Los Angeles. Our new life in the wilderness had begun. Chapter 2, Jack of One Season. The irony of being a working actor was that I was so busy globetrotting that I barely got to spend any time in my new home. In 1998, I made a deal to appear in 10 episodes of Hercules and Xena and to direct 2 of them. I regard the Hercules and Xena time period as a blast because of the creative nature of it. Rob Tappert and the other producers trusted us. Because it was syndicated, we didn't really have the overbearing infrastructure of a studio with endless nitpicky notes. Alas, Hercules and Xena ran their course after 6 seasons each. After almost a decade in the land of the long white cloud, Rob Tappert had cultivated not only an impressive episodic TV machine, but also an important reputation in syndicated television. When the Warrior Princess made her exit, an hour-long hole was left in the schedule, and Universal Studios and Rob had every intention of filling that slot. They were looking for another action-y set of shows to replace Swords and Sandals, ideally without pause. For better or worse, the next 2 shows came together very quickly. Back-to-back action hack. When a show like Hercules or Xena airs for 5 or 6 years, it is eventually going to lose viewership. That's just a fact of TV life. When viewership declines, the studio can't command #1 time slot anymore or get the highest advertising rates. Shows then get moved to less desirable slots. Therefore, some replacement shows started their run in downgraded slots, the harbinger of cancellation, in my opinion. Such was the case with Jack of All Trades and Cleopatra 2525. Nevertheless, the producers still wanted to continue the successful pairing of a guy show with a girl show. So they developed Jack and Cleopatra, 2 half-hour action comedies dubbed Back-to-Back Action Pack. It was a very rare, very strange combo that Rob somehow managed to sell to syndicators. Because we were no strangers to the Auckland setup, Rob tapped both myself and Josh Becker to help participate in the 2 shows. Mine was Jack of All Trades, a period piece about America's first international spy. I was intrigued by the concept. The story took place in 1801 and was set in the West Indies, where the United States had sent a spy to keep an eye on Napoleon, ultimately played by the great 2'8" Vern Troyer. Jack was basically what Zorro, one of my favorite characters as a kid, would be like if he had been played by comedian Bob Hope. The approach of the material was very much my sensibility. I liked borderline vaudeville humor. I enjoyed making fun of Thomas Jefferson, kings, and rich people in general. The model Rob had in mind was Hogan's Heroes. To Rob, the series should be confined to just one French-controlled Caribbean island and focus only on the ongoing conflict between the heroes and the island's goofy commandant. At the time, Josh and I objected to the rule that the show was never to leave the island of Pulau Pulau, and we tried to convince Rob that the show should take place along the Barbary Coast instead. From 1801 to 1805, the U.S. engaged in the very first Barbary War against four North African states, targeting the predatory pirates that captured American ships and held their crews hostage. One of the earliest deployments of the U.S. Marine Corps was to the Barbary Coast, and the opening lines of the Marines' hymn, not to mention the chorus of Joe LaDuca's Jack of All Trades theme song, pays homage to this Barbary baptism, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Beyond the battles between Marines and pirates, the region was rich with possibilities. You had sultans, princes, Dutch captains, tribal intrigues, which could have provided a sweeping, colorful canvas for a series. Alas, Rob shot it down. In this case, I think his production team feared the multiple sets and large cast that our angle might demand. While I feel the show was therefore doomed to claustrophobia, we at least tapped into the era by incorporating real historical characters such as Thomas Jefferson, Napoleon, Ben Franklin, and Blackbeard, even though the latter two were technically dead by 1801. Oh, well. Meanwhile, Josh had pitched Rob Tumathak of the Corridors, based on a 1932 Lovecraft-inspired public domain story. Set in an uninhabitable future occupied by spider aliens, humankind had to burrow underground progressively deeper to survive. Ultimately, they had been underground for thousands of years, and there were completely different civilizations on each layer. Like the story, the series would center on Tumathak, one guy who sees the light from way up top and thinks, what's up there? So Josh's Tumathak of the Corridors would have been this guy's journey to the surface of the Earth, with each season being a new layer with a whole new civilization. Finally, as a possible end to the series, he'd emerge into the surface through a manhole in Manhattan and get promptly flattened by a taxi cab. Well, Rob was intrigued, but he wasn't sold. He needed a girl show. As series development is known to do, each component of the original concept was individually removed, reworked, and replaced until only morsels of the original concept remained. In went Tumathak of the Corridors. Out came Cleopatra 2525, a series about a stripper who goes in for a boob job and wakes up in the 26th century. Long pause. Long pause. Somehow, a subterranean serial about survival got mixed up with the true story of an actress friend of mine who got a botched boob job in Canada and became one of the most ridiculous concepts ever recorded. In spite of all common sense or creative logic, Hogan's Heroes of the West Indies was produced along with Boob Job of the Corridors. Thus, this odd back-to-back action pack premiered with a roaring sigh on the shitty time slot left by a waning warrior princess. Co-exec of all trades. If I was going to be the star of a TV show again, I wanted it to be under the right circumstances. The big kahuna Rob Tappert, a pal for decades now, trusted me, and I always enjoyed the kind of creative lenience on the shows he produced in New Zealand. One of the other big men on campus was Eric Grundemann, a veteran of Herc and Xena, and someone who had been tolerating me since my temp sound days on Darkman. Eric was a completely sane producer, a rare delight, so I knew that working with him wasn't really going to feel like work. Part of my deal was that I was also co-executive producer, which meant I wasn't powerful enough to stand up against the studio, but I had almost enough power to make a costume designer do what I said. The title gave me a voice that people had to pretend to listen to, and it allowed me to work with more impunity. I had much more control on Jack than I did on The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., for example, where I was just an actor for hire on somebody else's show. Carlton Cuse was a very strong showrunner, and we rarely disagreed with any dialogue on Briscoe because it was good writing. Jack was always a more creative environment for me, and we would improvise and collaborate until everyone was happy. One sequence in particular had never been fully realized by the time we shot it, so we had no choice but to make it up on the spot. That day, we improvised every gag, every bit, every heel in the eye, every ass slap. As co-exec, I was free to shoot from the hip without having to call the studio for permission, and creatively, that's exactly where I wanted to be. Rob is robbed. Rob Tappert had spent the latter part of the 1990s cultivating his backlot, refining its infrastructure and amassing an impressive library of sets, props, costumes, and creatures. The now seasoned crew had become specialists in the production of adventure entertainment. Then something happened that decimated Rob's resources and left his studio in much worse shape than it should have been. Orcs invaded New Zealand. Peter Jackson started production on the Lord of the Rings trilogy in 1999, promptly engulfing and employing every able-bodied specialist in the production of Adventure Entertainment. Seemingly every armorer, best boy, focus puller, and four-foot-tall stand-in responded to Jackson's muster, including the effects team at Weta Workshop and Nyla Dixon, costume designer of the trilogy and Academy Award winner. The masked alias of my Batman of the West Indies character was the Daring Dragoon. A dragoon was a member of the Mounted Cavalry, an imposing soldier laying waste upon his impressive steed. Yeah, nice to want. Our beleaguered crew couldn't find a proper horse because the Fellowship of the Ring happened to prominently feature 9 black riders. As a result, every black or dark brown horse in New Zealand, Australia, and Papua New Guinea, however you pronounce that, had been acquired by Jackson, who paid as much as $250,000 for the most photogenic equine. All we could manage for the Daring Dragoon was a bony nag I sarcastically named Lightning. My ass still hurts. People ask me all the time what I think about the Lord of the Rings movies. My response is always the same. I hate them. But Bruce, these are Academy Award-winning billion-dollar box office movies, fans would breathlessly explain. I wouldn't know, I would clarify. I've never seen them. Then how could you hate them? The crestfallen fans would ask. Because Peter Jackson stole our whole Kiwi crew. Jack's brash character needed a vocal, headstrong counterpart to keep him in check. This came in the form of the British spy Amelia Rothschild, played by New Zealand actress Angela Dachin. As with many in the Kiwi talent pool, Ange cut her teeth in the New Zealand soap opera Shortland Street, then graduated to appear in 1 or 2 episodes of Young Hercules and Xena. In fact, we both appeared in the Xena episode Tsunami, during which I saved Ange's life, as she put it. In the episode, a massive ocean storm capsizes a ship carrying Xena, Gabrielle, Autolycus, and various guest characters. To simulate the underwater aspect of the story, a submerged set was constructed inside a giant water tank. Life imitates art, and the tank cracked open without warning, spilling more than 5,000 gallons of water in a virtual ocean storm of our own. Water flows in the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere. Perhaps that's why Angela ran toward the rupturing tank. I shoved her in the opposite direction, and my gallant heroism was hailed. The truth is, Angela probably would have gotten more dampened than drowned, but I milked her praise for all it was worth. The Jack production benefited from a combined 12 seasons of Herc and Xena, notably in executing fight scenes. Countless brawls and scuffles had been staged over the course of both shows, but I was never satisfied with the way they had been filmed. The procedure of the day, one that I bristled against, was to shoot the fights all in one uninterrupted piece, just like the stunt guys did. Look, that's fine if you have months to rehearse a complicated fight, but on a TV schedule, you're learning to fight the morning of the scene, so there isn't time for all the moves to sink in. I felt that the longer the fight scenes lasted, the sloppier and more dangerous they became. When Jack rolled around, we worked out a very straightforward formula for shooting fight sequences that I still use today. We broke each fight into a series of smaller, easier-to-execute beats. Each chunk, now shorter, could be shot with more safety and confidence and didn't take any more time to complete. To their credit, Herc and Xena established a rule that actors don't fight other actors. That may seem both obvious and absurd at the same time, but it was actually a very safe and successful guideline. Stunt guys are not known for their acting prowess, and actors are not known for their flawless stunt work. The master and wide shots for the fight scenes of Jack of All Trades were all staged with stunt people. In closer shots, if the daring dragoon was the focus, the French soldier fighting him was the stuntman, and vice versa. We ultimately got everything down to a nice, efficient science. No actors or stuntmen were injured during the season. Riding into the sunset again. 6 years had passed since I headlined The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., my first one-season wonder. Jack of All Trades was to be my second. At the end of the day, Jack was a woulda, coulda, shoulda scenario. There were a lot of good elements in place, but the show was hamstrung by its own self-imposed limitations. Crappy time slots didn't help either. When you're a young actor, your reaction to a failure is egocentric. It's me. It's my fault. They didn't like me. I guess I didn't try hard enough. Getting canceled after such a short burst can make an actor think that people only want you as a spice and sizzle, not as the whole meal. But after you've been around a while, you realize that it's not all about you. You're just a little cog in a larger set of wheels. Whatever the reason, I was faced with my second failure in a row as a leading man of a TV series. The saving grace for me was feeling confident that on both Jack and Briscoe, really good work was done by all participants. Both shows have, quote, aged well in the eyes of the public and have since become cult TV, a somehow fitting end. Chapter 3. Gnome, Sweet Gnome. Ida and I bought a very funky house, knowing that we could always fix it up. True vision must come from complete blindness, because we had no idea what we were getting into. For starters, the house, if you could call it that, was essentially the shape of a Quonset hut, but not all above ground. It was about half submerged with 18 inches of dirt on the roof. I personally had never lived in a hobbit house, but there were many pluses. The arch was a very sound structure and allowed for open spaces within the home. Because of the dirt above, the hottest summer day had virtually no effect on the interior temperature, and the same applied to winter. A single wood-burning stove was sufficient to heat the entire house, and there was no need for air conditioning of any kind. If you're a noise freak and like peace and quiet, a dirt roof is for you. Ida and I have slept through numerous wind, rain, and thunderstorm events because the natural insulation was such an effective barrier. Having said that, the place was very cave-like. The lower level, mostly underground, swallowed light. It was not unusual to have two or three lights on at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The curved shape is a square footage cheater as well. Furniture can never be placed too near the wall because you bang your head on the arched ceiling above you. The 1,100-square-foot house had been built 10 years previously by an eccentric English woman, and she lived alone. In retrospect, the house was perfect for one person. One bathroom, if you exclude the country toilet in the pantry. One main bedroom that was attached to a small greenhouse, a very tiny second room, and a mostly open upper floor, with the exception of cheesy cabinetry that blocked a million-dollar view out the windows. There were no building codes in Oregon until the 70s, and it allowed for some odd results. Because there were so many hippies in my neck of the woods, and still are, there are many single pieces of property with 6 or 7 habitable dwellings. Oregon locals are a hardy, self-sufficient bunch, and they like to build their own garages, pour their own concrete, and rewire their own electricity. Permits? Deal with that when you sell. Our house was not a model of building code compliance. A lot of New Age pioneering had been done since the initial construction phase. By definition, I mean work performed by unskilled laborers, whereby a proprietor hopes to save money, but ultimately wastes even more time in the end because the crappy work never lasts and has to be redone. Evidence of pioneering was everywhere in our house, from the keep-the-spirits-away quartz-laden wall in the greenhouse to the stove, which was attached via a bare copper tube to a barbecue-sized propane tank outside. Every sink, faucet, and showerhead had to be replaced, not so much to suit our taste, but because they had become so calcified from the well water that they no longer functioned properly. Item by item, we began to rip out, replace, and upgrade the house to the 20th century. Green Acres, Oregon Style. One of the more challenging projects was upgrading the telephone system. Two lines came into the house, with one jack upstairs and one down. In my world of home office, I needed a 6-pair line installed to meet my immediate needs. Easier said than done. For the sake of technological reference, my valley was using telephone party lines up until the 80s. Getting extra lines in the Oregon backcountry wasn't as easy as calling up the phone company and deciding whether it would be a morning installation or an evening one. Here's a letter I sent outlining the odyssey. Dear U.S. West, let's turn back the calendar to May 1998. I placed an order to add additional phone lines and voicemail. The installation was to be fulfilled approximately July 15th. Several days after that date, realizing that no U.S. West phone company representative had shown up, I placed a call to a customer service representative. Let's call him Leo. And I asked why. The answer that came back was simple yet astounding. The area of concern utilized an older system and doesn't provide the switching to connect a missed call to voicemail or provide the additional lines that you need. Leo from the Home Office Consulting Center in Phoenix, very far from where I live, didn't even know what systems were available in my quiet little valley before he placed the order. Recommendation number one, introduce the left hand to the right hand. Maybe throw a mixer. Together with Leo, I formulated Plan B, which was simple but challenging. Your company would dig a trench up the length of my property, 7/10 of a mile, lay a shiny new 6-pair line, and I would pay for it. Quick update. The work was completed in January of this year. In case you don't have a calendar handy, that's 9 months after the order was placed. I heard that there was a nasty little strike within your company during that time. Hey, everything work out okay? In June of this year, the subcontractors returned to bury the remainder of the exposed cable. That was the good news. The bad news was that in the process, they stretched it in one area and snapped the line. Then there was the water thing. After a temporary splice reconnected the phone line, the diligent trench-digging men scraped an old steel pipe several times. Undaunted by this, they continued their course until they hit the pipe again, this time severing it. To our mutual horror, this turned out to be the main water supply for approximately 3 families across the road. Imagine the angry phone calls I got. You probably have a record of them somewhere. Recommendation number 2. Update the trench digger's guide to trench digging by encouraging diggers to change course when encountering obstacles. Eventually, the severed line was repaired and all was well again in my happy valley. Until I wanted to get call waiting. I lost count of how many times I was told, next day by 6, or tomorrow by noon for sure. A customer service representative in Salt Lake City, let's call her Doris, informed me that I would have to call repairs if I wanted something done. I became perplexed. How can something be repaired if the service hasn't even taken place? Recommendation number 3. Take Team Phoenix and Team Salt Lake to a U.S. West corporate retreat for trust exercises and charades. Eventually, Doris said the call waiting problem was caused by a Centraflex system that had been on my line all along. In order to use call waiting, she instructed, I had to hit the flash button, then dial *9. The only odd thing about this conversation was that the programming solution came from Doris in repairs. Recommendation number 4. Close down customer service and let the repair department do everything. Corporations are always looking for ways to cut operational expenses, right? I'll give you that one for free. Over the last year or so, I tried to calculate exactly how much time I've spent on the phone talking to various representatives from both sales and repairs. After much tabulation, I realized that it was enough time to read How to Trench Responsibly, Companies That Are Too Big for Their Own Britches, and Waiting for Call Waiting, Cover to Cover. If U.S. West were my child, I would send it to the finest attention deficit disorder clinic in the nation. If you were my employee, I would fire you. If you were my employer, I would quit. Yours in eternally crabby regret, Bruce, I can't hear you, Campbell. Granted, verbal battles with corporate giants aren't anything new, but rural areas are even more neglected because equipment upgrades and service calls are always last on the corporate list. After much documented heartache, my damn 6-pair line was trenched. Installation to the actual house was next, but an insurmountable obstacle halted that process. Hunting season. Norm, the phone guy, warned me after he came over the first time for a look.
This is going to be easy, Mr. Campbell, but I got to warn you, I'm not going to be around from the 3rd through the 17th.
Oh, going on a vacation, I asked.
Nope. Elk season, high desert.
Yeah, I nodded like I knew what he was talking about. Right, of course. So, a couple weeks after elk season, the phone lines were installed and I could get on the internet. As I type this now, I laugh at how easy it has all become since. After all the aggravation, money, corporate incompetence, about a year later, satellite internet was introduced to my area, and being situated on a hill facing south, I was a prime candidate. The installation took one day, and there wasn't a trench in sight. Internet, done. Today, though, I still have no cellular service. I make calls via satellite as well. Phone service, done. By the time Ida and I declared construction sort of over, we had added an entry with level connecting walkways, poured concrete steps from one building to another, built a carport, carved out a park and a cafe, and rerouted the driveway in order to create a more pleasing Oak Savannah backyard. What we should have done, Ida and I realized later, was drop a bomb on the house and start from scratch. Footnote, it only took us 18 years, but Ida and I finally did just that. We destroyed the hippie haven and built us a proper house. I've got what on my property? Lavender. Specifically, Lavandin Grosso. It's a combination of cold hardy English and heat-tolerant Portuguese varieties. As it turns out, lavender has many medicinal uses, aside from its beautiful violet-blue flowers. During World War I, it was used in hospitals as an antibacterial agent. Today, it's promoted for its soothing properties and pleasing, not overpowering smell. Go figure. This was all news to me as Ida and I surveyed the acre or so of lavender at the lower end of our property. Southern Oregon is a lavender-friendly part of the world as it has hot, dry summers, and this mature crop was still doing very well. We decided to figure out this whole lavender thing and see what could be done with it. It turned out that the prep, harvest, and processing of lavender wasn't that big of a deal. It's a once-a-year harvest, usually late July. Other than that, you keep the plants drip irrigated, as they're not particularly thirsty and everything lies fallow in the winter. The harvest is done with hedge trimmers, and you cut where the stalk meets the ball of the plant. The stalks are gathered, tossed into the back of a U-Haul, destined for the distillery. Now, distillation is the fun part. Harvesting is just hot and backache-inducing, but distilling is where the sweet science of essential oils comes into play. Our lavender is loaded into a large, locking metal trailer with ventilated tubes fixed along the bottom. Once the cooking process begins, it's kind of like steaming broccoli. You keep the lid on it, crank up the heat. A couple hours later, the oil is skimmed off the top of a separate container, and voila, you've got lavender essential oil. Okay, Ida, that all sounds great. I said, where should we distill? How about Steven Seagal's ranch? Steven Seagal has a distillery? I guess so, she explained. In researching lavender, I came across his ranch manager. They grow all kinds of botanicals. I never would have used botanicals and Steven Seagal in the same sentence otherwise, but perhaps Bruce Campbell and lavender are a bit incongruous as well. Either way, off Ida and I went to distill our first batch of lavender. Over the years, as Ida did more research and development on what you can do with lavender, we began to make gifts for the casts and crews of various shows I worked on. Lavender products were particularly popular with the Miami-based Burn Notice crew. Quite literally, because of the unusually high heat index combined with long hours of manual labor, they tended to smell worse than any other crew. As a joke one year, Ida and I gave away lavender soap made from our oil. The response was swift and favorable. So yearly, we expanded our offerings to include lotions, balms, ointments, and dried lavender sachets. I knew we were onto something when our low-end products became addicting. One day during the Burn Notice shoot, a burly teamster lumbered up to me, invading my personal space. He was sweaty, of course, and he smelled just okay. Hey, Bruce, where's my fucking lavender this year? I'm starting to smell like shit over here. Come on! If you're expecting this chapter to go all Newman's Own, where Ida and I build a lavender empire from our humble beginnings, you can stop there. This was a losing venture from the start, and it always will be. We just do it for fun. Reconnecting. Blade Runner. When you're an actor, you have a lot of things done for you. You get driven to the film location. You get your meals prepped for you on set. Chances are you even have someone to run your errands, answer your phone, and feed your cats. Over time, you begin to feel like you've forgotten how to do anything. It's not necessarily the consequence of ego or wealth. There's a definite professional value in having others handle the distracting aspects of life so you can concentrate on your work. Rehearsing dialogue or writing screenplays takes focus, and it helps to know that certain things are off your plate entirely. Still, occasionally an actor finds himself stranded in the boonies of his own acreage without a personal assistant or teamster anywhere to be found. After I recovered from the initial shock of self-reliance, I embraced the new responsibilities of being a woodland landowner. One of the most pressing concerns was our driveway, which was 0.7 miles long, steep and unpaved. If it became impassable, we would be marooned. There were plenty of married retirees living in the valley, and one thing rural isolated couples discovered over time is that they can't stand the sight of their spouses anymore. Shockingly, long marriages imploded all around us, and I was opportunistic enough to buy a John Deere tractor from a neighbor who was liquidating his life during just such a divorce. With the tractor, I'd be able to blade the driveway, smoothing out all the ruts and packing down the loose dirt. The reason an unpaved driveway needs to be bladed is because of the washboards. Scrambling for traction, every two-wheel drive vehicle that trudges up the hill tears the road apart. The only problem with my new tractor was that I had no clue how to use it. So I did what people from the Midwest do. I called Sears. Fooled into thinking it was just a general service call, Sears would send out a technician to take a look at my tractor. Once he was there, I deftly weaseled the operating instructions out of him. "Hey," I asked, "is this the lever for the front loader thing?" Yeah, the Sears tech would explain, "but make sure the loader's engaged when you use it." "Yeah, of course. And, this thing is the, that's the electrohydraulic hitch control," the tech said, getting suspicious. "You ever drive this before?" "Oh, sure. Plenty of times," I would assure him. You may be wondering why I didn't just admit that I had bought a tractor without the slightest idea of how to make it work. Well, when you're best known for mounting a chainsaw in your hand and building death coasters, people just assume you're an expert in landscaping equipment. Over the course of the next 3 different service visits, I figured out how to operate my tractor. It wasn't all that different from a riding mower, and I finally worked up the courage to blade the driveway all by my big boy self. At first, I was primarily concerned with making it look nice and flat. The problem was that flat roads provided absolutely nowhere for rain to go. Water just pooled into puddles and turned my flat driveway into a craggy, uneven mess. After a few tries and the advice of a veteran blader, I finally discovered what road builders have probably known since ancient Rome. Roads need to be slightly higher in the middle. Eureka! Now rain had somewhere to go and my hard work wouldn't be washed away immediately. With that simple innovation, I went from having to blade my road weekly to only having to do it 2 or 3 times a year. I knew I'd finally nailed it when we were hosting a party for the Valley residents during our lavender harvest. Anticipating a parade of guests, I gave the driveway a fresh John Deere makeover. During the festivities, Scotty, a big tough rancher, moseyed over to me and asked, "Who did your driveway, son?" I did, sir. Not sure what his response would be. Scotty put a grizzled hand on my shoulder and smiled appreciatively. "That's a hell of a blade job, son." And with that, my initiation to Oregon was complete. Chapter 4, A Hunk of Bubba Love. "So, Don, are you going to see it? Are you going to see the dick?" I asked. "No," Don Coscarelli replied. "It's implied." Both the question and the answer were important because in Don's new movie, Bubba Hotep, the story revolved around a 68-year-old Elvis Presley in an East Texas rest home who was dying from cancer on his penis. I was asking Don because in considering the role of Elvis in this whacked-out story by Joe R. Lansdale, I wanted to know how far Don was going to go. Was he going John Waters far? Pink Flamingos far? If so, the movie would become something you couldn't take back. it would be knocking on the door of tastelessness. And although I've been in unrated movies and plenty of edgy stuff, that wouldn't be something I was looking for. Once I had cleared that major hurdle, the next question concerned my litmus test for low-budget productions. How long is the shoot? I didn't ask that because I was lazy and hoped for a mercifully short shooting schedule so I could golf more. I asked because in the movies without budgets world I tend to inhabit, shooting length can be the difference between doable and no fucking way. If Don was hoping to bang this thing out in 2 or 3 weeks, like a lot of ultra-low-budget filmmakers, I knew it would be time to walk away Ray. 6 weeks, Don said, reassuringly. We got to get this right. That was all I needed to hear. Great, I exclaimed. I'm in. I knew of Don Coscarelli, but I didn't really know him before shooting Bubba Ho-Tep. Don, like we did with Evil Dead, started out in the world of nano-budget genre movies, very handmade stuff, and his first effort, Phantasm, became a cult classic. I've always had respect for people who go their own way creatively, and Don fit the bill quite nicely. Joe Lansdale, by my way of thinking, also had an enviable career writing pretty much anything he damn well pleased. When not penning mostly dark, homespun material, Joe is a martial arts expert, dog lover, and small-town Texas man who has mostly shunned mainstream Hollywood. My kind of guy. The elements were in place. Now I had to get ready to play the king. Although the Elvis character in this story was a geriatric 68, a few flashbacks featured Elvis performing live late in his career. Terrified that I actually had to get on stage and emulate a performer whose live acts were actually astonishing, I tracked down an Elvis impersonator and scheduled a session ASAP. My session with, let's go with, Ken, wasn't as long and exhausting as you might expect. In fact, it was rather short, mostly because Ken gave up on me halfway through. It all started innocently enough with Ken regaling me about the time he wore a jumpsuit that Elvis actually wore. I was doing this charity gig, see, on the Vegas Strip. I called up the jumpsuit company that made the outfits for Elvis. There's only one company in the whole country that makes them. But dig this, Ken continued, using vernacular like the king. If they made a jumpsuit for you, they owned it. You had to give it back, even Elvis. Well, that sounds draconian, I remarked, wondering where his story was going. Yeah, so anyway, I asked if I could wear an actual suit Elvis wore for this charity deal, and they say, okay. See, me and the king were similar in size, so it fit me like a glove. I still wasn't sure if this story was cool or creepy. So there I was, baby, doing my thing on stage, and I started to sweat. Boy, did Elvis sweat. Watch the Hawaii comeback concert on YouTube. You'll know what I mean. To put it bluntly, Elvis sweat like a fat pig. With a crappy diet and lots of pharmaceuticals, I can only imagine the heinous fluids emanating from those famous pores. Now, Ken explained, because of all the sequins on the jumpsuit, they couldn't really wash those things. They could only steam them, so old Elvis, he'd get a little ripe, see? So to cover up the smell of B.O. or whatnot, Elvis would use Brute. He'd dump the shit all over himself. By this time, I was pretty sure Ken's story was going to turn creepy. I was right.
Well, I'm doing my thing on stage, and I start to heat up real good, Ken elaborated, his eyes widening at the magical memory. Next thing I know, the smell of Brute, albeit 30 years old, starts to come out of the suit. It was the same smell as the king. I knew it was legit. I was channeling Elvis Dan Presley, best show I ever gave.
Desperate to avoid becoming entwined in another slightly homoerotic story, I cheerily clapped my hands together.
Hey, great story, Ken. Hey, you want to try some moves?
Ken ran me through the particulars of stage posture, microphone holding techniques, and general hip thrusting gyrations, but it didn't last long. After about 5 minutes of watching me attempting to thrust my pelvis, Ken threw up his hands. He'd had enough.
Look, man, you're never going to get it. Let's just call it quits.
As far as research goes, I was on my own. By the time I became aware of Elvis Aaron Presley, he was a washed-up, bloated ghost of his former self, touring mindlessly to support his over-the-top lifestyle and avoid dealing with the ruins of his life. But Elvis in his heyday was something. Frank Sinatra was the first singer to drive teenagers insane, but nobody drove them as insane as Elvis. Bubba Ho-Tep, even with a ridiculous plot, an aging Elvis teams up with a black man who thinks he's JFK to save a rest home from a soul-sucking mummy, had a sweet core. deep inside all the crazy antics, there was an engaging, redemptive story lurking. Bubba was ultimately a quiet meditation about aging and usefulness. This is what I connected with and tried to get across in the characterization. I watched a lot of footage of Elvis. YouTube is the modern actor's research library. Want to see Elvis's last concert? It's there. Want to see his posse, drunk and crying, in an interview a decade after Elvis's passing? It's there. My takeaway was that Elvis had it all and lost it all. Fame, fortune, relevance, and it pushed him over the edge. Ultimately, he was a supremely talented, not fully formed human being who found out too soon that the dream of riches and fame could easily become a nightmare. In addition to learning how Elvis moved, talked, and sang, I had to try and look like him. Thankfully, my Elvis was mostly 68 years old in the movie, so we were in uncharted territory. To sell the main illusion of Elvis, two things were critical: the hair and the almost ever-present sunglasses. We could use your actual hair, makeup whiz Melanie Tooker explained, but if we use a wig, we can match it perfectly. She was right. Even without doing anything else, the wig got me halfway home. Elvis's sunglasses took it the rest of the way. There is something so iconic about them, you just start talking like Elvis. The second you put them on, you can't help it. Don Coscarelli got in touch with the aforementioned jumpsuit manufacturer, which amazingly still made elaborate outfits, and still wanted them back when we were done. For the flick, I ended up with three bitchin' outfits: white, black, and a vibrant blue. What I wouldn't give to have those suckers hanging in my closet now. Drunken karaoke nights would never be the same. Some locations don't need a lot of work to be camera ready. This ancient World War II era veterans facility in Downey, California was one such place. Used to house countless vets after a devastating war, then abandoned due to neglect and consolidation, the sprawling compound already had dank, interminable hallways, peeling lead-based paint and banks of unflushable toilets. The smell alone made the location all too real. Shooting Bubba wasn't much different from other low-budget movies, but after a brief chat with the boom man, the person responsible for recording every word out of my mouth, it dawned on me how low-budget this movie actually was. "So, Mike, you excited to work on this wacky flick?" I asked, using my most pleasant first day of filming vocal inflections. "Oh, I sure am," Mike said, fairly beaming. "This is the first movie I ever worked on." I went pale. "So, Mike, you've never held a boom pole in your hand before?" "Nope, but I'm sure excited to learn." I'm not usually an asshole on set, but I raised a finger and pointed it at Mike's face. It wasn't a threatening gesture, but it wasn't a friendly one either. "Now you listen to me, Mike. I don't like looping. You don't even know what that means, so I'll tell you. Looping is what actors do if they haven't been recorded properly. Do you understand? I've found that performances always suffer in the looping process. Granted, with wind machines and talkative directors, there are cases where you can't avoid replacing some dialogue, but to me, looping means that we failed on set." "We can't fail, Mike," I concluded sternly. "You have to record every one of my lines like your life depended on it." I said it with a smile, but Mike knew deep down I was not kidding. Mercifully, Mike did a great job, and 99% of my dialogue was recorded perfectly. Ossie Davis was a revelation. By the time he worked on Bubba, he was already 83 years old. This was to be his second-to-last performance. You could tell that Ossie was a guy who didn't have bad habits. He didn't smoke, didn't seem like he was a drinker, his mind was still very sharp. Ossie was a good steward of his instrument. The first time I met him was on set. "Now, Ossie, I know why I'm in this movie, but what are you doing in this movie?" "When I got the script, I showed it to my grandkids," he explained. "They said, 'Oh, Grandpa, you got to do this.'" Apparently, the youngsters were fans enough of Evil Dead to recommend the gig. We were grateful to have him. Ozzy lent a huge amount of overall credibility to the film just by being there. An actor of tremendous poise and charm, he classed up the joint. Lest we forget, Ozzy's first film was around 1945. He has since been honored with Lifetime Achievement Awards, Kennedy Center Awards, a Grammy, Daytime Emmy. I could go on. Most substantially, he was an ardent civil rights activist who delivered the eulogy of Malcolm X. Mr. Ossie Davis was an impressive man. When you shoot a horror movie, a lot of things will never change. Creepy locations, working at night, fake fog, fake blood, prosthetic makeup, and inevitably, monsters. In those respects, Bubba Ho-Tep was no different, and the shoot plodded along. Horror movies don't race, they plod, because all the aforementioned elements take more time to do. Don Coscarelli was slow and methodical in his